Welcome to a podcast of a sermon delivered at the Unitarian Society of Ridgewood in New Jersey. Our congregation is a place where you will find inspiration in the richness of diverse beliefs and the power of community. Detailed information about the Unitarian Society of Ridgewood is available on our website, uuridgewood.org.
Through this quiet hour breathes the worship of ages, the cathedral of music of history. Three unseen guests attend, faith, hope, and love. Let all our hearts prepare them place.
May we be in a spirit for meditation or prayer. May this be a time of quiet, of allowing our thoughts to leave daily concerns and move toward awareness of those gathered here with us, friends, family, strangers, times of community, of simply being with others in this space familiar, even precious, to us, or perhaps unfamiliar to us, seeking here a welcome, perhaps a comfort, something of a blessing amid these days which may be for us a time of anxiety and uncertainty. May we sense a welcome here, a place of warmth, of safety, and of acceptance. May we love and remember how to heal ourselves. Amen. Jack Kornfield is a former psychologist. He's now an American Buddhist master. His introductory book, A Path with Heart, continues to be one of the most significant sources that I have taken along on my spiritual journey. Now, I'm not generally attracted to anything that one might find on the self-help shelves of bookstores. In fact, I'm often openly hostile to most of that genre. But I was fortunately caught by the subtitle of Kornfield's book, A Path with Heart. The subtitle, First the Ecstasy, Then the Laundry. It's about demystifying the spiritual practice, revealing the value and the rewards of spirituality in everyday life. Now, like the Buddhist Thich Nhat Hanh, Kornfield makes the suspect term spiritual accessible, even tempting, for the curious but perhaps self-designated contemporary sophisticate who simply doesn't go along with that sort of thing. In the foreword to A Path with Heart, Kornfield writes of his early days after gaining a PhD in psychology of learning in Thailand to become a Buddhist monk. Now, his first difficulty with that process was learning to bow. And bowing was central to the Buddhist way. Each time the monks entered the meditation hall, they would drop to their knees on the stone floor and bow three times with their head between their palms, a way of demonstrating that their commitment to simplicity, to mindfulness and compassion. But Cornfield wasn't yet fully into this bowing process. As a novice, he remained some vestige of the cosmopolitan, sophisticated academic. So after a short time, one of the senior monks took him aside and said, "In this monastery, you must not only bow when you enter the hall, but also each time you meet one of your elders." So Cornfield asked, "Well, who are my elders?" And they were, he was told, everyone who had preceded him in ordination. In other words, everybody. And so he bowed to everyone. And sometimes it was easy enough. There were many elders in that monastery who were known far and wide for their wisdom and their piety. But, he writes, "I would also encounter some 21-year-old monk full of himself, haughty, full of pride, only there to please his parents or because the food was better." And he says, "I had to bow to a sloppy old farmer who was continually chewing betel nuts, who had come to the monastery only the season before and had never meditated a day in his life. He must pay reverence to them all." But he began to find a way to make this bowing to everyone meaningful. He began to look for some worthy value in each person he encountered. He bowed to the old farmer's eyes, which held all the suffering he had seen and triumphed over. He bowed to the energy and the playfulness of the young monks and the beauty of life that lay ahead of them. He bowed to his elders. He bowed before entering his forest hut. He writes, "If it moved, I bowed to it." And he soon began to enjoy bowing. Now, as Thornfield learned, there are two aspects to this matter of bowing. One is bowing as a matter of knowing, of honoring, of showing respect, of demonstrating a perhaps unaccustomed humility. And the other is an expression of welcoming. Westerners, that's perhaps Americans in particular, have a particular difficulty with such a thing as bowing. It has to do with a mindfulness of independence, of the democratic spirit, the rejection of all myths of divine right, the foolishness of royal blood, of high birth, of privileges, of wealth. In spite of the evidence, the rule to live by, even if it is a cultural deceit, is that no one is better than anyone else. And along with these difficulties is a suspicion of religious hierarchy, of religious authority, and yes, of reverence, like the Reverend Doctor. It's a surprise to Americans who visit Unitarianism in Transylvania to discover that Transylvanian Unitarians have bishops. bishops. Now, we are the inheritors of that Western dualism, which divides the world between subject and object, between good and evil. We are the inheritors of that patriarchal God, who, it was written, created the sea and the heavens, and finally formed the human creatures to rule it all. And it is written, God blessed them and said to them, be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth and subdue it and have dominion over the fish of the sea and the birds of the air and over every living thing that moves upon the earth. Well, we've more than fulfilled that commission, haven't we? This commission to subdue the earth is a construct defiantly maintained, nurtured, and fortified. The proud patriarchal myth orders the seas to be polluted, the air fouled, and the Amazon forest burned to the ground. It has separated us from kinship with the natural world, from what our Unitarian seventh principle asserts as respect for that interdependent web of all existence of which we are a part. Learning to bow is a way of reconciling and reconnecting with that near forgotten relationship with the world, of recognizing and honoring the preciousness of which we too often forget we are a part. I think it's fair to say that most Western men, in particular, have maintained an innate dread of what might appear to be a weakness, an inheritance that since the invention of the club to the intercontinental nuclear missile has led men to be ever ready to prove their strength, superiority, and their rights. If there is some vestigial readiness to arm wrestle across corporations and national borders, such spiritual disciplines as Buddhism teaches us that there is a countervailing gesture to fold the hands in reverence and humility. Now, Cornfield recommends this clasped hand bow, which expresses that the God in me honors the God in you. And in a way, the first principle of Unitarian Universalism expresses this. We gather to affirm the inherent worth and dignity of every person. The clasped hands is a worthy practice. But I don't expect you to leave this morning to go about, as Cornfield said, bowing to everything and everybody you see. The bow can be an inner gesture, an inner sense of appreciation, or with a simple nod to acknowledge with clasped hands and bow the inherent value of everything before us. First, the ecstasy, then the laundry. Learning to bow can be learning to enrich even the most mundane, perhaps the most routine of the moments and the actions of the dailiness of our lives and our routines. A few years ago, my youngest daughter and I visited a Japanese garden on Mount Desert Island in Maine. As we approached the garden, the young woman who tended the sand garden came to prepare it for the day. And before she stepped over the boundary into the garden, she knelt briefly, bowed her hands and her head, and prayed her prayer. And I thought of that time, and to this day, I think, what a gift that is, to have a work that is exalted by a bow before it is begun, that we should have such a job for Labor Day. I continue to think that perhaps the work that any of us do, that any of us might be transformed by even that inward sense of bow. That young woman who tended a sacred garden led me to bow before I begin to work, hoping to maintain the conviction that what I am about to do is an honor no less than tending a sacred garden. Welcoming the other aspect of the bow, excuse me, welcoming the lovely summer morning, welcoming the visit of a dear friend, welcoming the team from the Publishers Clearinghouse. All this is easy welcome, and welcome we can easily understand. But our lives, each life, can be deeply enriched by learning to welcome so much more of the full depth and breadth of human experience. Again, perhaps with the exception of some native peoples, we Westerners are mainly dualists. We have learned to divide experience into good and evil, welcome and unwelcome, accepted and denied. The Persian poet Rumi put it this way: this being human is a guest house. Every morning, a new arrival, a joy, a depression, a meanness, some momentary awareness comes as an unexpected visitor. Welcome and entertain them all, even if they are a cloud of sorrows who violently sweep that house of all your furniture. Still treat each guest honorably. He may be clearing you out for some new delight. The dark thought, the shame, the malice, meet them at the door laughing and invite them in. Be grateful for whoever comes, because each has been sent as a guide to what lies beyond. Well, that's asking a lot. And I'd hate to tell you what I would have said to that some years ago had some visitor had the temerity to read it to me as I was recovering from heart surgery. There is little or nothing in our Western culture to support the idea of welcoming whatever comes. The proud British culture that formed me, gave me A.E. Henley, who wrote, "In the fell clutch of circumstance, I have not winced or cried aloud under the bludgeoning of choice or chance. My head is bloody but unbowed. It matters not how straight the gate, how charged with punishment the scroll. I am the master of my fate. I am the captain of my soul." Now add to that some Rudyard Kipling rot about how to be a man, and you've got someone who will welcome nothing that has not been ordered, who will deny or fight literally sometimes to the death every intrusion at the door, and who will rage against the dying of the light. Well, those are words to build an empire by. This being human is a guest house, Rumi wrote, and every day a new arrival. And what is sent to us is not always ideal. But what is sent to us is what is. Not to be open to all that comes, not to let anything in but Mrs. Feelgood, is to attempt to live in a make-believe world. And what does that mean? Who, whoopee, look, cancer has come. Come on in. Does it mean lying down and waiting for disease, suffering, to carry us off? Not by any means. Acceptance of what visits us does not mean suicide or the death of the soul or the spirit. But denial, that can mean suicide, virtual or actual, raging at the God of the universe, lying down in defeat can be suicide. The poet Philip Larkin wrote, "Death is no different whined at than understood." Bowing to what comes to us is not lying down before it as surrender to an enemy, but in terms of welcoming, means engaging with it, listening to it, and yes, learning whatever may be learned from it. One of the friends Anne Lamott writes about in her book, Tender Mercies, Traveling Mercies, excuse me. One of her friends has AIDS. She says he bows to what is. He bows to that reality in his life. And with that, he lives a life as well as he is able. And he says he is living with a disease-threatening life. There's a phenomenon in psychotherapy. It's a reaction I often encountered in working with troubled persons. It's called secondary symptoms. I've also thought of it as the "oh my God" response. It's expressed as, "oh my God, I'm anxious," or "oh my God, I'm depressed." Rather than learning to accept such visitors, the sufferer compounds the emotional pain with panic, with useless fear. Raging against such visitors, attempting to bar the door against them, may only add weight to their threat. I am intimately familiar with an almost lifelong depression. Paul Simon's classic song could almost be my theme song. Hello, darkness, my old friend. Now, depression is certainly not an old friend I go looking for when I have a free evening. But I did eventually, with a lot of help, learn to welcome it as being what is. What is today? What is tonight? What is this week? Raging against what has come to us serves only to make it stronger, more determined, more destructive, more disruptive. I know that whistling a happy tune fools neither me nor those around me, or the depression itself, which is very smart. I accept my depression as being every bit of my life, as are the gifts and the joys of my life. When this visitor arrives, I live in it and with it, and I live through it without the compounding panic. I know I will live. And when it leaves, as I know it will, I welcome my life without it. And aging, as the writer and artist, perennial misfit Alexander King wrote, mine enemy grows older. The universal state which every human being must either welcome and befriend or go down fighting. The aunt who all but raised me during the war years in England died just a few months ago at the age of 97. My mother died at 96. My grandmother at the age of 90. And she may still have been at your door offering you a copy of the Jehovah's Witness Awake magazine. To have something one believes that much. It seemed to me that the visiting years of all these women were welcomed by them in their time, welcomed with their own gifts of a fine mixture of trial and joy. Someone said, if you're going to practice forgiveness, start with something less than the Holocaust. Learning to bow, to welcome all life, as the Buddhists teach, that engages all life. I helped three of my children learn how to ride a bicycle, and in retrospect, and I say in retrospect, the teaching was a joy. With each child, if you've been there, you know. With each child, in spite of their protests, we started with training wheels. Those two small wheels that serve for a while to keep the balance until suddenly it seems the balance appears as natural as breathing. Again, the attitude of bowing, whether it's actual or inward, the attitude of honoring, of revering, of humility, is not natural to our Western heritage. The attitude for a while will seem off balance without training wheels. It will feel foreign to our minds and our bodies. Reverence for life, as Alfred Schweitzer puts it, is a way of learning to welcome new ways of being. So what's all this in for me? Why should we do it? Who needs it? Why am I bothering to talk about it? Well, because our lives can experience more balance, because we can live with less stress, less disabling anxiety and wasteful depression. We can live with more self-acceptance, more comfort with ourselves as we are, and with our lives as they are. Cornfield writes, to bow to the facts of our life's sorrows and betrayals is to accept them and to discover that the heart holds more freedom and compassion for self and others and the world than we can imagine. That's the payoff. That's the reward for learning to bow, to accept what comes. The discovery that we can hold more of life's full reality. With this discovery, we can learn with less fear, less anger, less despair, and in that we live more disease-resistant lives. A teacher says, it is helpful to realize that this very body we have, that's sitting here right now, with its aches and its pleasures, is exactly what we need to be fully human. Amen. Mary Oliver writes, when death comes like a hungry bear in autumn, when death comes and takes all the bright colors and coins from his purse to buy me and snaps the purse shut, I want to step through the door full of curiosity, wondering what it will be like, that cottage of darkness. And therefore I look upon everything as a brotherhood and a sisterhood. And I think of each life as a flower, as common as a field daisy, and as singular as each body a lion of courage, and something precious to the earth. When it is over, I want to say, all my life, I was a bride married to amazement. I was a bridegroom taking the world into my arms. Please join me in our words for extinguishing the candle. We extinguish the flame, but not the light of truth, the warmth of love, and the energy of action burn bright in our hearts until we are together again. Amen.